for some of us.
This is
great.
But on Wednesday, Dr. DuPont will come in and talk about disused cortisone pathway atrophy. Then on the 13th, Kevin Murak is going to be here. He used to be at Ball State, and he's a postdoc up in the labs. Talk about myogenesis, myogenic PAX7, and those other markers for regeneration of muscle. Then Dr. Peterson will come talk about aging. And if you're...
So November 16th is a Thursday.
Okay, then.
just, you know.
Just
I know it's early.
Know.
I'm just letting you know.
We never get a break, do we?
No, I don't have a wait.
Oh, well, oh yeah, there's one.
That's probably unnecessary.
No, it's relevant. Thank you. No, I appreciate that. So, aging or aging, depending on where you live.
Good. So, should we turn on the other mic? Or wait?
You turn off all the lights, I'm not going to stare at you.
Your presentation is presenting itself right now.
Yeah.
Bring it to where we were.
Oh, I gotcha.
Okay. Yeah, so it's like my lecture capacity.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Where's it? So we're getting there. So we're back on, and this is on echo, I hope.
Yes, I think it is. Let's make sure this is on. Yes.
Okay, so because we had a little change in schedule, we'll just try to wrap up a little bit on some of the comparative aspects we didn't get to. Maybe it'll help with one of the questions that, if you haven't gotten to it already, think about where that might be answered. We left off talking about muscle structure and some of the benefits. Remember, we covered a lot of comparative aspects, different animals with different lengths of sarcomeres, quite a variety in the invertebrate world, right? So from long sarcomeres to short sarcomeres, just recap a little bit. What were some of the advantages of having a long sarcomere versus a short sarcomere? Anybody remember?
Powerful movement.
Which one has more, can generate more force? Any idea of our... For sustained force, like we were talking about, the longer sarcomere, because it's in series, right? Versus the shorter sarcomeres, fast, generally that's the way it goes, right? But there's some exceptions to these. And generally, when we were talking about in the invertebrates, fast and slow muscle, is slow, you know, when we say slow, general slow, that's the way a lot of invertebrate people reference it. Is that the slow muscle fibers themselves were usually thicker in diameter compared to the fast muscle fibers, which are smaller in diameter. And then, remember, the other issue is the size of that muscle fiber itself. It can't be so thick because why? What's the problem if we have a lot of contractile elements really packed in and getting really thick? The access to calcium, right? So you can't get it diffused in, so you see the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you know, spaced in some cases pretty well throughout that muscle, so it's not really super thick. And people have looked at comparisons about the diffusion, how far it could actually diffuse into a thick contractile element region. So a lot of variety out in the invertebrate world, and we'll cover a little bit more of some aspects. So that was basically the take home of a lot of what talked about. Some of the crustaceans really were super powerful in the sense of the amount of power that they could generate compared to others. But as people were mentioning too, which muscle are they looking at, and temperature makes a difference in many of the invertebrates, and even the age, as we'll talk about a little bit this morning as well. So there's a lot of variety out there in the world to look at. So this, we left off talking about some of the models with the invertebrate world, and this particular preparation of tarantula muscle. Who would know that they would, you know, look at the tarantula muscle, but people try to look at everything. Just for some odd reason, it really holds together really well in an isolated structure to be able to image this tarantula muscle with these techniques where mammalian muscle fell apart. So they can get a pretty good image of the myosin heads and the arm and get a better representation of it than they could in some mammalian preparation. So it seems to be a model that people are using to understand more about the structure of the myosin heads by using a tarantula preparation. So you never know what weight you're out there, you know? Keep looking at a variety of different animals. So some of this is quite interesting. This was a paper I sent to you right after class because this was really quite different. And the squid preparation, so the squid, if you remember, maybe you know, it has the arms, main arms, right? And then it has those two kind of long projections that go out and they can snag an animal really quick, like a fish or something like that. And those can project out quickly and then retract quickly. So they thought, oh, there must be different types of myosin, ATPase, inside of those muscles that go out really fast and withdraw really quick compared to the other muscles. So they've actually been through and looked at the different muscles and they found the same type of myosin isoforms in all the muscles. So it wasn't really the differences of myosin isoforms. So that's kind of interesting. And that maybe it has to do really with the structure of it. So they looked at these myosin isoforms. They found three different types, generally. But they found them in all the tissues that they looked at. And they didn't really see a differential expression. So in this case, it didn't seem to be the myosin isoforms, or the ATPase activity in there, but more or less the structure of the muscle. So in that paper, the general take-home here was that these tentacle muscles that go really quick and come back, they have this cross striation. So in case you don't remember what this cross striation is, it's some kind of arrangement like this. This is from a different paper, but just to understand the difference. So this cross striation like this, where it's off from the actins that come off of each of the Z-discs, basically. And so that was unique in these really fast fibers. But look also, the sarcomeres were only 0.8 micron thick filament lengths, so really short, right? Whereas the other muscles, where they had the ones were slower, their sarcomeres were much longer, 7.4. So here in the same animal, with generally the same myosin ATPase activities that they could see, but there's differences in the sarcomere lengths. So kind of unusual in that sense. And that's thought to be the main difference that they basically came through, and that these longer sarcomeres actually have this completely striated arrangement. So you see that this is a little bit different than what we've seen before. So they think it had to do a lot more with the structure of the differences in the sarcomeres, but they did make a point in the paper that they didn't look at other factors, other biochemical factors that could be other type of associated proteins and things like this. But at least it wasn't just the ATPase activity differences. So that's basically the take on there. So that was kind of interesting that there's something of unusual within this animal in the squid. Who would know? And then just to hear some comparative aspects, Titan has different isoforms of different animals. Remember that one picture we had a long time ago about showing that people can back up on this kind of meat that falls up with this, see how far back it is? I think we had it way back here somewhere. Yeah, there it is. All these different animals with the different proteins in different regions of the sarcomere. And we were talking about that not all of them are the same type of proteins. Some take some different forms, but maybe even serving different purposes in these animals, but generally in different arrangements of the sarcomere. And we didn't have to see the other hands with, oh, here it is, this one has a kinase, but switching. But the one that we, and here's Titan, that they call it Titan, but people have actually called it Tibetan. And it's also in the other hand. So it might be an isoform of the Titan that we were talking about. So just in case you hear of Kinetin, I'm seeing active filaments and localizes around the Z-disc. So it might be one of these isoforms of Titan that's basically in the invertebrate world.
Okay, so a little bit about wonderful animals in the crustacean world. They're just wonderful. Besides to eat, but they're really good to work with. And we talked a little bit about it in general. So this is a general phenomenon in the crustacean world that they have these generally three classifications that they talk about with skeletal muscle. Long sarcomeres, intermediate, and short sarcomeres. And we've already talked about generate a lot of force, muscle fast responses, right? And if you look at the electrical properties, it seems to be different too. So if you stab with an intracellular electrode, generally these long fibers are slow muscle fibers, and they have graded potentials. So unlike us, these muscle fibers aren't firing action potentials. They're graded responses, kind of like a dendrite in your nervous system. So they're graded. The more depolarization, the more contraction. But something else that's unusual in the invertebrates, particularly in some of the insects, you don't see so much sarcoplasmic reticulum. They might not even have any protofibrils or sarcoplasmic reticulum in some of these invertebrates. Because the muscle fibers are relatively small, they're not really super thick. And where do many of the invertebrates get their calcium from muscle contraction? Not from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but actually from the plasma membrane. Full ischemic calcium channels on the plasma membrane itself. Like Drosophila and crayfish, the calcium comes to the plasma membrane. So all you do is just depolarize the plasma membrane. All right, so that's interesting. And then if you go to the other extreme, here's the short fibers. They generally give rise to larger PSPs, and sometimes they spike. Not all the time, but sometimes they spike. So it's interesting that you get these differences, and then you can see the variety of differences in the rate of contraction and the type of location of these muscles for their kind of movements. I think you mentioned about the lobster claw and the cutter, the crusher and the cutter before. The crusher has a lot of slow muscle fibers, really strong. You can crush a barnacle, for example. The cutter muscle fiber are fast muscle fibers for cutting the prey up in little pieces, so if needed, basically. So it's kind of neat. And you hear stories in the crustacean world about like lobster fishermen that go out and catch lobsters, and you know how they wave maybe with holding up one finger left because they've lost all their other fingers. It's because the lobster can actually be so strong. If you take a pencil, for example, and go to Kroger, buy a lobster, and say you're going to cook it, but if it's so healthy, before you cook it, you can put a pencil in its claw, for example. Its crusher, it'll just break that pencil in two. And it can actually do a lot of damage to your hand if it happens to get a hold of it. So the idea is that those people mentioned if they ever get bit by a lobster claw, they basically throw it on the ground as hard as they can and step on the claw to crush it before it breaks their finger off. So it's going to be a bad situation. So that's how strong those are. Okay, so if we look a little bit more about the sarcomere types, this is long, intermediate, short, we talked about, rate of development, I mean, of tension development, then just like we talked about, long for slow and short ones for fast. And there's some units there, as you can see how fast this is, 1 kilogram per centimeter per second, 40 kilograms per centimeter squared per second, that's a pretty drastic difference. And something about the membrane resistance as well for developing the electrical events. So in general, this fits that we have differences in the membrane resistance. Why that's important is just to think about the electrical conduction down the muscle fiber. Right? If you have a high resistance, then you don't lose your potential so well. And so you maintain that depolarization. If it's a low resistance, it means there's a lot of holes, then you lose your potential as you travel along the muscle. So you might want a larger spike, so you have a bigger event to start with, so it'll actually get to the inside of the muscle, not just have contraction or the innervation. Okay, so if we look a little bit more about some of these muscles, it's interesting to think about the innervation that goes together with some of these muscle fiber types, because of how muscle develops, at least generally. These particular muscles in different animals, so don't try to memorize different types of species names, but in general, like these are crab preparations. Here's a crayfish and a lobster, and another crab up there at the top.
these muscles that are tonic all have a single excitatory axon that innervates that muscle fiber. Anybody remember the neurotransmitter in generally for invertebrate skeletal muscles? Gamma-beta, glycine, acetylcholine, epinephrine, glutamate, all the above, glutamate, right? It's glutamate, okay? And so the majority of animals in the world actually use glutamate as the neurotransmitter at the skeletal neuromuscular junction. So this is an interesting picture. Usually, if we present at a neuroscience meeting, for example, or some meetings that's more or less even experimental biology, where there's APS there, people question sometimes the poster, and they're wondering, what do you mean, glutamate, and not familiar with it. Or maybe they're not even familiar with the invertebrate preparation that you can have, a single muscle fiber, single cell, innervated by two types of motor neurons. So the single fiber can be innervated by fast motor neurons as well as slow motor neurons. And then you have some fibers that are only innervated by fast and other ones that are innervated only by slow. But not shown on this, these are all excitatory, glutamate. But not shown on this, you can also have inhibitory motor nerve terminals innervating these muscle fibers. What's really odd, you can have in some preparations in the leg, you can have what's called a common inhibitor, which will innervate all the muscles, and then you can have specific inhibitors that innervate just some of the muscle fibers. So now you can have a muscle fiber that can have like five different motor neurons innervating it. Maybe a common inhibitor, a specific inhibitor, a phasic exciter, a slow exciter, and then maybe an intermediate type of exciter. Not only that, the inhibitors can actually inhibit presynaptically on the motor neuron. So on the nerve terminal, you can have an inhibitor which will actually synapse onto the presynaptic nerve terminal of the excitatory axon. So the inhibitor releases GABA. The exciter is glutamate. How does it inhibit presynaptically? Well, if you release GABA, these type of receptors on the postsynaptic muscle motor nerve terminal are GABAergic A receptors. They're inotropic. They open up, become chloride channels, basically. So if the chloride potential is low, like the resting membrane potential of the cell, then when an action potential comes down, what's going to happen? If it hits that region of the nerve terminal, and you're depolarized way up here, like almost maybe plus 10 millivolts, and it hits that spot where the open chloride channels are, it's going to go right down to the dechloride equilibrium potential, right? So it's going to short-circuit it, and if it brings it back down to rest, what can't open here? Voltage-gated calcium channels, right? So it can't open voltage-gated calcium channels. You can't get the vesicles to fuse. So it can short-circuit it before it even gets down to releasing transmitter and the presynaptic nerve terminal. But not only that, that inhibitor will not only inhibit the presynaptic nerve terminal, it'll inhibit the muscle too. So it's really inhibiting any kind of excitatory input onto that fiber. So basically, a lot of people use the invertebrate skeletal muscles as looking at integration of synaptic input. Because you've got exciters, you've got inhibitors, you've got different types of exciters, and you can begin to understand the dynamics. And so people model invertebrate preparations to try to understand how your central nervous system actually works, like integration of signals. So just something to think about. It's odd. So you think about these muscle fibers too. Isn't it weird that you could get this type that's releasing a little bit, causing contraction, and then all of a sudden this one to fire, boom, and then you get a fast contraction on top of the same muscle fiber. That's pretty odd to think about. Does anybody remember the particular oddity that's in mammals that we can have this is considered polyneuronal innervation? Anybody remember the particular muscle in the mammalians that's polyneuronally innervated skeletal muscle? It's an odd muscle mass. Just in case you ever ask wild, crazy question about
it. Is it the extraocular muscles?
Yes, the ocular muscles, the extraocular muscles. And Paco Andrade in physiology worked on these types of muscles for a while too. So there's different innervations in the belly of the ocular muscle versus the ends of the ocular muscle. So that's kind of interesting too. That's the only case I know of in a man.
handle mammalians that are. Oh, is it laryngeal muscles?
Laryngeal muscles.
Laryngeal muscles? Okay, great. Okay, so we've got two.
Yeah, they're very similar to the doctor.
Okay. Maybe they come from the same embryological type of origin.
They do.
Because they're different than the somites from the rest of the body.
Yeah, they all come, the patients come from the same groupers that they've had the other two.
So neat. Some really neat aspects of this. Okay, so we've already kind of talked about some of these differences. People are interested in what develops basic and tonic type of innervations in crustaceans, as well as in mammalian models, right? So genetic factors, maybe the timing of the innervation, right? If it's innervated early by phasic or tonic, does that differentiate that muscle fiber type? So people are interested in this in the invertebrate world as well. How is there competition? You know, we talk about competition for mammalian muscle fibers, right, for innervation. Well, which one gets there, which one's higher output is the one that's going to stay and the other one regresses, right? But now we have in the invertebrate world two types of motor neurons on the same muscle fiber. And why doesn't one, you know, withdraw, basically? How is it that it maintains the innervation for both? And then when that muscle grows, the nerve terminal has to grow with it. And so that's kind of odd. Right? So lots of things to think about in the developmental aspects of these. So here comes something interesting that might be related to something that you've seen recently. In this crab muscle, in this limb of stretcher muscle, they've actually looked at the mean sarcomere length. The main thing is the limb bud as it grows. Look how in a juvenile, young animal, it's only 0.4, and in the adult, it's growing, and the limb's growing, the length of that limb bud, and in the adult, look at the sarcomere length. It's changing. So the sarcomere length is changing. Is that right, Bill? Something? Questions? All right. So here we, and the facilitation, this is facilitation, this FE is facilitation index. So it actually facilitates better when it was a shorter sarcomere, and it facilitates less when it's actually a longer sarcomere in this case. So this is really interesting when you think about this. This is done a long time ago, right?
So it continues to change in adulthood too?
I don't know. In the adult, it's pretty much, it's not growing much more, you know, so it's pretty much reached its terminal. So these crabs have basically a terminal molt, so they won't get much larger. Some of the crustaceans that don't have terminal molts that continue to grow, you might have heard of those lobster crabs. You see those, you know, teeth of giant lobster. Yeah. So that particular animal seems not to have a terminal molt, so this creature sets up. But many of the crabs have a terminal molt, and they won't end up getting much larger.
Do they grow in proportion to each other, or is it?
Well, it's kind of, yeah, it grows, well, they can see like 3.2 to 0.4, and, you know, 1.1, so that's doubled, basically, right? Or a little bit more than doubled.
Yeah.
And look at the difference here. So it's growing kind of slow here, but then it jumped tremendously as an adult. So that's basically the take. So it's not staying the same as we always hear about in other textbooks, right? The sarcomere for that animal is set size, and then it doesn't really grow much more in length, but in some of these animals it does. So it's interesting to think about. And to think about that development of muscle fiber type, they know in this particular little muscle that's in the limb of the crab, it's called this flexor muscle, that the innervation is different in the animal. So as the innervation comes across these muscle fibers, here's least mature muscle fibers, so the muscle fibers are still developing and getting their phenotype. And then the more mature muscle fibers, the older ones here, are getting innervated at an earlier time, and then these nerve terminals grow with the muscle fiber. So just to kind of recap, getting our brain in the same mindset, in mammalian muscles, remember you have an implant like in the belly of the muscle fiber. Many of the invertebrates, it's not just an implant, but it makes multiple terminals all over the muscle fiber. And the reason is because if it's graded, you don't want just a synaptic response in the middle, and then that graded depolarization to decay before it gets to the ends, so you have multiple innervation sites, so you have a greater response that will basically allow the muscle to contract equally and not just in the belly, right? So these terminals actually grow and make more synaptic contacts as the muscle fiber grows, and they've noticed that in this particular muscle, even though it's innervated by pretty much the same nerve,
look what happens. These are tonic, and these are more phasic muscle fibers. So it might have to do with the time of innervation that actually helps to develop these muscle fibers. So people look at these preparations. What's really nice is you can actually cut these nerves and have them regrow, or you can actually take a donor, which some people have done, they're taking a donor kind of ganglion, if you will, out of the whole animal, the ventral nerve cord. They've taken a whole ganglion in the roots in exotransplant into another animal and actually allow that nerve to innervate the muscle fibers and to see what happens, and they can innervate at different times, see if the isoform changes in muscle fibers, for example, or would another nerve be able to innervate those muscle fibers if you got rid of the intrinsic muscle, the nerve that's actually innervating those muscle fibers. So a lot of playground to use these preparations. But people have had a hard time culturing crustacean muscles or insect muscles in a dish, so they try to do these inside the animal instead. So that's a bit of a difference. Okay, then we got our beautiful preparation, crayfish, which just spend the whole day talking about crayfish. We'll go on. But it's really an interesting preparation. For one thing is that if you look at the little claw right here, these are the first two chelated, the first two legs, walking legs, are actually chelated just like the claw, but they're small. Just a little side note, all the crustacean crayfish in the fossil record actually have all the legs chelated. So it seems like they've lost it in evolution somewhere, that just the first two walking legs and then the claws, the chelae themselves are chelated. Interesting aspect. But what's really interesting is if you take that opener, cut it, the leg, cut it right through here, get rid of the closer muscle, turn it upside down, and now you have the opener muscle. And as I mentioned before, they don't have tendons, right? Because they don't have internal skeleton. The cuticle invaginated and made an apophyte, basically, like a tendon. So right down the middle is the tendon. And the muscles come off in this pinnate arrangement. But something really interesting is if we look at these muscle fibers down here, they're very small. And they're long. And these muscle fibers, the individual fibers, are actually thicker and they're shorter. And so there's differences in the arrangement of these muscle fibers on here. But not only that, if you put an intracellular electrode in this preparation, you actually get different types of responses in these different muscle fibers when you stimulate them. And this is innervated by a single excitatory motor neuron. So a single motor neuron, single excitatory motor neuron, is innervating all these muscle fibers. So that's kind of odd, right? You have a single excitatory motor neuron innervating all these muscle fibers. If you stimulate it at 20 hertz and you're recording the excitatory postsynaptic potentials, or EPSPs, you have to actually facilitate them, repetitively stimulate, before you can really basically even see the depolarizations. The muscle will contract. Right? If you go to a higher stimulation frequency, and they can go as high as 80 hertz to fire, as people have recorded like EMG electrodes, you know, in the cuticle looking at intact down. So basically, if it wants to contract strongly, higher firing frequency is the only way it can do it. It can't recruit more motor neurons, right? There's only one motor neuron. So the only way that this can increase its development force is actually to increase that higher firing frequency. So this is a little bit different than you think of recruitment of motor neurons. So it's the firing frequency, in this case, develops more force retention in the animal. So it's really interesting to think of these synaptic, what might be differences in these regions. So here's a synapse of a crayfish, neuromuscular junction, vesicles, synaptic structure, postsynaptic site, muscle fiber. And you see these. So people look at those vesicles and synaptic properties. And we'll come back to the opener just a little bit. Let's think about another muscle that's in the leg. It's the next segment up, the leg extensor muscle. What's really interesting here is you stab one of these muscle fibers, and it's innervated by two types of excitatory motor neurons. Two types of motor neurons. Stimulate one, you actually have to facilitate it to get a response after repetitively stimulate. Stimulate the other, a single action potential down the nerve generates a very large EPSP. So that motor nerve would generate, you know, quick boom, contraction, where the other one,
have nothing if we just gave a single action potential. We would have to repetitively stimulate at a higher frequency. If you stain the nerve terminals, you actually see differences in the nerve terminal innervation. So here's one that makes big varicosities, and the other one is this tiny little wispy thing that goes across like this. Which one do you think gives rise to which response? Any idea? Bigger, better, small, powerful, small, wimpy. What's the deal?
There's a chance there.
Exactly.
I would say the small would be the graded kind of temporal spatial.
Possibly. That's what a lot of people thought. Actually, that's very good. So 50%.
Actually, it's a big one. That actually gives rise to the smaller responses. But this big one, you can keep firing it. So what's really odd, you sound this cellular electrode, you stimulate just the large exciter, the large proton one, tonic one, nerve, and you can keep that thing firing for hours. You can go at 10 hertz, and 2 hours later come back, and it's facilitated, and it just keeps going. Like a little ever-rated bunny rabbit, you know, it just keeps going, right? Whereas if you stimulate the basic one, and you look at the response, it will start to depress. But is it really the muscle that fatigued? Because we're not measuring muscle force, we're measuring the synaptic response, right? If you turn around, and then after the basic one's depressed, you turn around and stimulate the other one, the one with the bigger varicosities, it will give rise to the responses just fine. So in this case, and you can still get the muscle to contract. So it's not muscle fatigue, it seems to be the nerve terminals that fatigue in this kind of preparation. We're usually in the mindset, oh, the muscle fatigue. Is it not in this case at all?
Lack of uptake of glutamate?
Well, I think in the nerve terminals, in the thin little wispy ones, there's very few mitochondria. But at the synapse, there's tons of vesicles packed. And then it seems to be that maybe it's depleting the vesicle recycling package. Not maybe the glutamate itself, but it could be because that's ATP-dependent process, but maybe the whole recycling of the vesicles. So it's interesting, in this case, it's not muscle fatigue, it's more nerve terminal fatigue. It makes you kind of question, what about us? You know, and is it really nerve terminal, or how much is it really muscle fatigue? Right? And fatigue's a hard concept to understand in a whole animal, right? Because it's psychological. But... All right, so if we looked at those nerve terminals, and yes, we call them basic and tonic, but then those people are basic, and then the tonic ones with the varicosities, but then what's the muscle fiber type? You know, it has basic and tonic, it has some other neurons. So it's muscle fiber type. That's kind of interesting to think about. And actually, just a little bit of people have looked at the nerve terminals and sectioned them and looked at differences in the synaptic structure. Take home on the synaptic structure of high output and low output nerve terminals, and it's thought that the muscle actually influences how those nerve terminals are actually made, right? The synapse, so it's muscle-centric a bit too. So if we look at the synapse, an axon on these vesicles dog, the serial sections through that preparation, you come up with a general phenomenon. And you can even stain up these nerve terminals with antibody stains for vesicle pools. So this is antibodies antagonism, their vesicles will cluster. You can do the same kind of staining of course taxon of the GAD calcium channels. You see this clustering. These are where the synapses are. So it's different than a frog, a mammalian end plate. They can have synapses all around the varicosity, on all sides, top, bottom, because it kind of gets incorporated in the subsequently plasma membrane. So let's look at a little bit of some of those differences back on that opener prep that we talked about. If we record in these different regions, look at the differences. The EPSPs, the trains stimulated at the same frequency, but these ones give rise to the large response initially, and then they facilitate. These are little wimpy things, but in the center, it's even more wimpy, right? And giving a rise to the response. And these are just deeper fibers down the side. So that's really neat. But then you think about one motor neuron innervating this whole muscle fiber, right? Whole muscle, these different fibers. So what do you think might be different in the sense of the function of this preparation?
I mean, if it's going to give rise to fire action, you know, series of action potentials down that nerve, you're going to get these muscle fibers, these muscle fibers, and that kind of response to those muscle fibers. And it has to open that clock. So people are thinking about trying to understand these arrangements in crustacean preparations because it's so unique. Maybe it's still, what do you have to do when you start moving? You have to overcome the inertia, right? Maybe these help you to overcome the inertia initially. Boom. And you pull on that tendon or that apnea and start it to move. But maybe these then can maintain that, depending on the firing frequency, right?
So the type of claw that would just stay open?
It can,
let a
yes.
fish
yeah.
come in and then...
Yes, and then snap down. Because it's the same type of arrangement in the big claws of the animal as well. So maybe inertia, maybe slow tonic type of response. We haven't talked about it too much in here, but you've heard of Golgi tendon organs, right? Golgi tendon organs in the base where the tendon and the muscle join together. The sensory endings, they monitor that force of contraction. Stretch-activated ion channels open up, right, from the poles. Greater depolarization in the nerve sensory ending. And then it gets to a certain level, then boom, fires an action potential, travels up, right? And then we, you know, it's telling our body, our nervous system, that maybe there's too much tension being pulled on that. Well, what about these animals? Do they have tension receptors? Can they monitor tension force contraction? They don't want to contract too hard, maybe they would tear their muscle fibers, right? So in insects, I think some of those might be actually in the cuticle. But the cuticle is pretty thick in these animals, right? So how does the animal know not to fire too much that it might damage the muscle fiber? Really interesting. They have tension receptors. And so people look through apodemes and crustaceans, and usually they always find these tension receptors, but there's very few of them. So all the tension receptors are actually right up here in the most distal region. They're not down here. And how is this happening? So here's the cuticle invaginating, making the apodeme, right? But the nerve, actually, the cell bodies for the equivalent of Golgi tendon organs are actually right next to the sensory endings. And many invertebrates, like the hairs or an invertebrate, the cell body for that sensory neuron is right there at the base of that hair. Not like us, dorsal root ganglion way up here, right somewhere. It's actually right by the sensory ending. So the action potential initiated is down there and travels right on up. So the cell bodies are really right close to the sensory endings. And they, so here's that invaginated apodeme or tendon, cell bodies out here, sends a little sensory ending into the cuticle, and it can detect the pull on that apodeme because of the layers that are in there. It's endocuticle, there's kind of the middle cuticle, and there's the exoskeleton on the inside. So it's not the way the muscle attaches, it can actually shear, all the shearing, on that apodeme, and that's how it detects tension. So it's pretty interesting. They did the quick release studies, like you do on muscles, that if you're monitoring the Golgi tendon organ, you develop a lot of tension, and then you quickly release it, the tension drops, and the firing drops of the Golgi tendon organ, right? So they've done the same things with these type of tension receptors, and show they have the same properties as Golgi tendon organs. So the same high response to passive tension as well, and then the higher firing frequency, more tension develops. So it's kind of interesting, the only monitor up there, and they can detect these forces that generate. Pretty cool. So what's also interesting is the nerve terminals in these regions look different. If you look at these in the proximal region, they're short, and they have these varicosities across. Remember, it's just a single side toward the nerve. And then if you look in these regions, they have these long nerve terminals. That's kind of odd. What makes a difference? How does it come about? And if you cut the diagram here, you see these long branches where they have those short branches, and muscle fiber thickness is really thin here compared to these muscle fibers that are quite thick in diameter. So odd. What makes it a different nerve terminal? It's from the same cell body, right? But depending on the target, you have different types of structure. And then you think of that last preparation that we talked about, the extensor, that was long wispy ones, and then you have varicosities. So could it be that muscle determines the type of nerve terminal? But in the leg extensor, it has two types of nerve terminals, and they're different. This preparation has a one excitatory nerve terminal,
but depending on the muscle it innervates, it has different types of structure. So that's obvious. And we'll kind of go through this really quick. If you record the different regions of these nerve terminals, these first varicosities are the original ones, they're high output, and then that nerve terminal continues to grow on the muscle fiber as the muscle fiber grows. So it actually continues to grow. But the tips of the nerve terminal are actually lower output than the primary varicosities, so these are more mature than these. We look at those ones on those thin little muscle fibers, these are much higher output. So this is mean model content, like how many vesicles fused when stimulated. These are much higher output than the primary varicosities over here on those long nerve terminals. So there's differences in the nerve, in the structure of these. And people think that the muscle is giving some kind of feedback to the nerve terminal, causing these structural differences. And if we look at a nerve terminal, you know, synapse, remember where vesicles fuse and cause the synaptic structure, you have to have calcium come in, so it's blue is calcium domain. So calcium has to come in and then cause the vesicle to fuse. Well, what makes it different in these different regions for synaptic transmission? You reconstruct these nerve terminals, serially reconstruct them. Here's a synapse, here's a synapse, here's a synapse. See all the different synapses. It's not the synaptic structure, which is commonly referred to in mammalian preparations that give rise to higher output, lower output. It's actually the complexity of the synapse. So some of these very large synapses do not have what's called any active zones where vesicles will cluster. But they have a pre- and postsynaptic thickening. But there's no site where vesicles really cluster around. So it's odd. So it's not synaptic size. It's actually the complexity. And what we see here is, look at this synapse. This is that one synapse reconstructed. These have multiple active zones on them. And these are relatively close together. So what might you anticipate? You have two active zones close together. An action sensor comes down. Calcium comes in. Calcium is how many vesicles use. Maybe having two active zones close together, you get a bigger calcium domain. So this has been looked at and modeled. And here's active zones far apart. Here they're coming closer together. And you can actually model an increased calcium domain. And then your probability of vesicle release is much higher here than it would be on a synapse that only has, say, one active zone. So the idea is that they look at calcium imaging, that correlates with this as well. And so that's really quite neat. So think about the differences in synapses. And is it the muscle that's causing that difference, right? So people have looked at these differences, and you can kind of figure out what's going on with maybe the feedback regulation in these muscle fibers to cause the nerve terminals to be different. So let's look at the muscle fiber differences. So we've actually done this with Don Michaels. He's a god in the freefish crustacean world, all the crustaceans pretty much, and looking at muscle fiber types. He's developed antibodies for muscle fiber types, APPase, differences, isoforms in crustaceans and lobsters and crabs. And one time we met him at a meeting, he said, well, why don't you try your crayfish preparation and see what happens. So here are those proximal, the distal muscle fibers. So proximal is those thin ones. The distal ones are the end of the opener muscle. And you actually see that there were differences in the banding patterns of these particular proteins. So this is troponin I, troponin T. There's this weird property that's inside of muscles and crustaceans called P75. It's thought to be a paramyxin, which is much like tropomyxin. And so that might actually be differences. So these isoforms that he's actually looking at in lobsters, it looks like there might be differences in the crayfish muscle, proximal to distal components, teeth in particular. So that's kind of neat that these muscle fibers appear to be different. And the general difference is that these are more of a fast type of muscle fiber. And these are a slow type of muscle fiber, and these are more of an intermediate type. But it's all innervated by a single excitatory motor neuron. So does a fast muscle fiber type cause these terminals to develop this way, and a slow muscle fiber type cause these terminals to develop that way?
That's still a question that's out there, trying to understand what's going on.
But it's pretty neat to think about muscle influencing the nerve terminal, retrograde type of input. So like I mentioned, this particular preparation, if you look at a single, potentially activate the basic, and if you do that, stimulate it, it hurts compression really quickly. But if we turn around and stimulate the excited for the blowout, but right here, we can get a very nice response. We can still get muscle to contract. So it's not the muscle fiber, it's the nerve terminal that compresses. Crustaceans are really odd. Beautiful piece. If we look at the abdomen, and we use this in our physics class a lot, you take the abdomen, head up here, I know it's horrible, you have to go to the fish, cut it over here, you cut open the bottom part, remove the bottom part, and then look at the muscles at the top, and the dorsal aspect. It has this very odd muscle. So here's the midline of the animal, it's right down the midline, and here's the midline. The muscle right off the midline has this kind of circular arrangement. It's like this. It just comes like this. Isn't that odd? And when it contracts, it shortens down and becomes smaller like that. But it allows the abdomen to extend back out. So if the tail flips, rapid extension, that's those big muscles that you eat like in Red Lobster. But it has to have the tail to go back out to tail flip again, right? And these muscles do that. They allow it to come back quickly. But it's a very odd arrangement, so people have actually tried to model. They're very small in diameter. So what did we say? Basic muscle fibers, exactly that's what they are. They're really high output synaptic responses, so phasic, very thin, short sarcomeres. And they range like that, and they actually kind of tighten up. And it's kind of interesting because it really doesn't shorten like you think in a longitudinal way, it's just wrapping around and squeezing down on it. And then next to those are these long muscles, L1, L2, and these are also fixed. Underneath these muscles, close to the surface, there's more strap muscles right here, and those are tonic. And then there's this little side muscle that's over here, and it's tonic. And it allows the abdomen to kind of rotate sideways. Right? So in the same contraction plane, we have the same kind of movement, we have tonic muscles underneath these, and then we have tonic muscles kind of give it a sideways movement. Because that's our subconscious pull this abdomen out for a long time. You can do that also. It does that in some postural keys, and it probably uses the tonic muscles for that. But if it needs to do this really quickly, then it uses these phasic muscles. And if you look at the nerve terminals, this is the same type of arrangement again. Long, little, wispy ones on the basic muscle fiber types, and on the tonic muscles, we see these long varicosities. These are the muscles that are on there. And long terminals.
What do the intersections between these muscle fibers look like? You know, like, because there's some fibers pulling in this plane and some fibers pulling in this plane. So what is the intersection between those two?
Oh, these go underneath these.
Oh.
Okay. So these are on top.
Oh, it's just hard because it's like a one-dimensional structure. I'm like picturing them intersecting, like, how do they not pull each other apart?
Yeah. No, these are attached to the cuticle here. And then they attach actually across the segment to the next cuticle, and there's our articulating membrane here. So it can allow it to twist, gotcha. And then these pull this direction, which allows it to step back.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. And the muscle receptor organs, you should hear of this, it's actually two tiny little fibers that are underneath these muscles in the extended region. What are muscle receptor organs? They're the same as your muscle spindles. Same arrangement. Two muscle fibers that stand in this region, and they have two sensory nerves associated with them. So think of two muscle fibers, one, two nerves. The cell bodies are gigantic on those preparations. They are really large, and when you pull on it, one of those nerves fires during the pull and stops. And the other nerve, when you pull on this, it continues to fire. When you hold it, it just keeps firing. What does that remind you of? Your muscle spindles. So this is referred to as a muscle spindle, or muscle receptor organ, in the crustacean preparation. So again, dynamic and static, sensory endings, and those muscle fibers haven't been looked at. We had a speaker here 2 weeks ago, Leah, from Georgia, right? Yeah, from Atlanta. And she came up and talked, and she's actually working with Ken Campbell on looking at muscle spindle muscle fibers
And so we sit in mammals, right, because of the differences, and wondering how these muscle spindles, what's their sarcomeres, and do they show differences in their properties, like their phasic and tonic type, and those interfusal muscles. And then we talked about the MRO, and she was so excited because she actually had an invertebrate background, and she used to work in cockroaches. So she said, I didn't know people still working on the MRO. So we sent her our data that we had from our class that did these things. And people are still do not know the type of sensory endings, the stretch-activated ion channels in the muscle spindles of us, how they work, what are their properties, and their pharmacological properties. Because some drugs will block stretch-activated ion channels, like streptomycin, antibiotic, actually blocks stretch-activated ion channels. They're sensitive to pH. Different types of isoforms are sensitive to pH. So think about your muscle when you're really exercising. What happens? CO2 is produced, pH drops. Could that alter how your muscle spindles function? Because if they have a certain properties of stretch-activated ion channels, those can shut down. So then you become uncoordinated, right? So maybe that's an interesting aspect of, with runners that are really running really hard, maybe being discoordinated. Nobody's looked at these yet, so it's really quite interesting to understand how those stretch-activated ion channels, what type are they, what properties do they have. So the MRO is really neat because it's a nice model, like your muscle spindles. And not only do they have the sensory endings, but guess what? They have motor innervation to those interfusal muscles, just like your muscle spindles, to do what? When it relaxes, what does it do? Those muscle fibers can become flaccid, right? So the motor neurons fire and keep those muscles taut. Doesn't that remind you of a gamma loop in us, right? They keep the muscle spindle taut when it becomes relaxed. So it's the equivalent kind of preparation. So really neat. Let's go back to these craziness of... what time is it? Oh, good job. Time goes of the muscles of these types of claws. So this is a lasis in the rat model, and you can see the different myosin isoforms up here, basically. So this is by Ron Michaels did this, and Will Long-Term Rose at the Strawberry imprint. And he does this kind of unusual thing. He has these gels at different percents, and you can actually get better separation of the myosin isoforms depending on the percent of the gel, the SDS H gels, right? So he actually does this and he can get different, better separation of the banding patterns. So when we started to look at the claw and crayfish muscles in the abdomen, this is a slow muscle fiber, this is a fast muscle fiber, this is a fast muscle fiber, this is an intermediate muscle fiber. These are the distal muscle fibers on the opener, which is the intermediate type. So intermediate, fast, slow. This is like purely slow. So you see differences in the myosin isoforms, which then she just broke them up into C1, 2, 3, and 4, which might then be related in the sense of their properties of contraction, but nobody's followed up any more than they really this level. So kind of interesting to think about. So we had an undergraduate that's very interested in looking at conditioning of crayfish muscles. Because if you look at these basic muscles in the tail of a crayfish in the summer, up in like in the New York area, the crayfish that live up there, they actually have a lot of basic responses in the winter time. So in the winter, you stack a muscle fiber, look at BPSP, you get a big BPSP. And it can move really quick. Look at it in the summer, the same muscle in that animal, same species. And now the EPSPs are smaller and they don't fatigue as quickly. Well, in the winter, these animals just hunker down in the burrow and don't move. So they're not really losing the muscles much. In the summer, they're out moving around, escaping from the predators and everything, and the muscles are used a lot more and has different properties. But it's the same general muscle. So she wanted to look at these muscles in the lab situation to see if just by stimulating could we get differences. So in the crayfish, which is really interesting, it has a ventral nerve cord, ganglion, and the nerve runs right over, right next to the cuticle as it goes to intermediate muscles in the top. So you can put two electrodes on each side of the nerve, you can stimulate them, and actually then make that nerve fire, make sure that it's firing, put two little electrodes under the cuticle, and you can measure the EMG response, basically. And then do a sham control on the other side, right? Basically, they do the same thing. What's really nice is you have this animal, you know, on one side kind of a control, and the other side you're stimulating, but the whole animal will move, so it's going to get the passive movement without really stimulating those nerves. But you can also look at other animals that you just put in wires in as a control as well. Basically, what she looked at was kind of neat. These are those muscles. Here's that circular muscle I was talking about. Here's those L1, L2 muscles. And the difference is, if you look at the nerve terminals after conditioning, they actually make increased swellings. So this is kind of neat. And we might go through and actually do electron microscopy to see if the terminals change, like the numbers of vesicles and synapses have changed at all. So she conditioned these for 3 weeks and actually then saw these differences in the nerve terminal formation. She looked at some of the banding patterns. This was some of our early work in running jellies, which was a nightmare. But anyways, now those people that want to look at mice and isoforms want to go in there and look at these type of muscles and actually see if we have any different isoforms to be expressed. We haven't done that. The difference, so here's on the innervation though, 3 weeks conditioning every day, for like an hour every day for 3 weeks, and then let it go, and then you go in, open it up, stab the muscle fiber, stimulate the nerve, and repetitively stimulate it. So it plenty hurts. In normal preparation, feeling presses very fast. In an animal that you condition, you actually have a lower EPSP amplitude, but it lasts a long time. So it became fatigue resistant. You do this in other preparations and you get different grades. But within that animal, so you look at the other side you didn't stimulate compared to the side you did condition, and you get to see that you've basically changed the properties of the muscle in the nerve. So maybe it's more in the nerve than the muscle, you know, because you're measuring the electrical response to synaptic transmission. And then it's actually compressed again about 50%. It's kind of like what happened in the summer and winter crayfish that they saw in those animals, but we're able to recapitulate that in a lab with just electrical stimulating the nerve. And again, fatigue resistant, very much like what happened in the field. So beautiful little preparations of crayfish. All y'all want to switch now, right? You won't get any money for it. That's what I said to you.
And then so does that change from like summer to winter? Is that similar to like a hibernation of a different species where they wouldn't atrophy?
Yes, similar in that aspect. And it's interesting because in those winter animals, and this is a perfect segue to this next spot, is that when they're inactive, why don't they see more muscle atrophy?
Yeah, that's what I was curious.
They don't see a lot of muscle atrophy. So that's really odd, right? What's happening? It's not being used that much. But the nerve's still innervating the muscle fibers. Now, keep that in mind. What if, remember, crustaceans are really useful animals. You can pinch them on the claw or the walking leg, and they'll say, I want to donate that leg to science, right? And they autonomize, just like a lizard's tail. They pick it up by the tail, and it breaks off so it can escape when a predator grabs it. So the crustaceans are the same way, crabs and crayfish and those animals. You can pinch it on the leg, and then there's a special spot that autonomizes, donates the leg to your experiments, and they can regrow a new leg. They can do that with all the legs and the chelicerae as well.
Even the big...
The big what?
Can they even do that with the big claw?
I mean, so now this one autonomized its right side.
Yes.
And so it only has the less claw now. And crayfish are, unlike lobsters, most crayfish are asymmetric. I mean, symmetric, not like a lobster, which is an asymmetric cutter and crusher, but many of the crayfish do. You cannot see differences with the right and left claws. They look very similar. It's not like a cutter and crusher. So it's kind of interesting. So this one donated its claw, and it's going to regenerate. You know, we can't do that. So what happens to the muscle that raises that claw up? That's heavy. You know, it's a big claw. Even though it's in the water, I mean, think of a lobster. It's big claws, right? It has to raise that up to kind of defend or fight. It can't be dragging it and walking. It raises them up. It raises up the bumper cars and walks around, right? So that's heavy, right? It doesn't have air in there. It's actually dense, right? So what happens to that muscle? It's like synergistic ablation in a sense, right? Now that muscle is gone, so it's not going to have that weight, and then you add it back, or you could actually put weights on the claw and actually exercise the clock, right? So make it have heavier weight and see what happens to that clock. So people are playing around with these kind of muscles. So it's really interesting. Look at this, what's called levator muscle, the one that levates up. This is in this animal that after 3 months it lost it, and as an adult it can't regenerate the clock so quickly. So after 3 months, look what happened. This is the intact side. This is the autonomized side. Muscle fibers are tiny little things. They just atrophy tremendously. And if you look at it after you cut out in the process for electron microscopy, it's osmotic peroxide and fixation. Look at the size difference of those muscle fibers. Wow, what a difference, right? So that's really neat. And what about the innervation pattern? These muscles are multiply innervated, multiple exciters, and have an inhibitor as well. So if you look at the muscle fibers, and you actually say, oh, this is just the GABAergic, the inhibitor, but actually, you see all the innervation. When you look at these muscles here, it looks like it's hyper-innervated. All these terminals are in this tiny little muscle, and you stand it up, and it's just all these terminals all over the muscle. You think the whole thing is just like a nerve terminal, but it's all in a muscle fiber. How could that function that way? Because if you excited that tiny little muscle, what's going to happen? Probably tear off, right? So how does it compensate as it atrophies, but still has that, all that innervation? How does it compensate not to tear that muscle, not to get, you know, so much synaptic transmission, right? Tear that muscle. Well, what's really interesting is if you section across there and look at the electron microscopy, this is the intact side, that's the muscle. These are nerve terminals. You see all those vesicles in there, and there's some synapses somewhere. This is subsynaptic reticulum around the muscle. You see the nerve terminals and vesicles. See, if you look at the autonomized side, you can barely even, there's a few vesicles here, but the nerve terminals are still there, they're still big, but there's no vesicles in there. And the synapses seem to be gone. So here's a muscle that's not being used. It still has a nerve terminal, so if you just stand for nerve terminal innervation, you would think that there's a lot of innervation on there, but it's non-functional. So it tells you you have to do like the electron microscopy, or you have to stain for vesicles or synaptic structure to really understand, or measure the physiology to really understand what's going on. So it's kind of neat. Somehow, without having use of that muscle, and is it because the nerve quit firing? Because now it just has a little stump. Maybe it doesn't need to fire, right? Or maybe it shuts down when it doesn't have its claw. What's causing that muscle to atrophy so much? Probably no load on it anymore. But what's the innervation? You know, what's the frequency of firing? Or when it tries to raise its claw, does that muscle still fire? Right. Nobody knows. Nobody's followed that through. Or could it shut down that side, knowing that it doesn't have a claw? Who knows? Okay, so that's kind of neat. So if we think of synapse formation maintenance, just to kind of quickly go through a few of these slides, it's kind of fun. You know, we could look at this all day. But a little bit of synapse is very important for muscle development and function and how the muscle integrates with all this. Muscles, synapse, right? Vesicles. And what's really odd, too, is you look at this mitochondria. It's very small in the nerve terminal. But the mitochondria in the muscle is gigantic. It's the size of the nerve terminal, generally. So how is it that the mitochondria can be so different and the nerve terminal so small and the muscle fiber so big, right? That's a whole other mystery that we learn about that. So some of this activity dependence is in what might the muscle contribute back to the nerve terminal. And that's what people are kind of interested in. So if you look at the general idea of innervation and the mammalian systems, you can have multiple terminals on your muscle fiber. Somehow they might communicate to each other and cause the other one to regress. So the one with the most activity is going to stay there in the mammalian systems, right? The one that's dominant. But what causes what signals actually cause the other one to regress? This is still a bit of a mystery, understanding what's going on. In our innervation pattern, our muscles, it was thought that it was pretty stable. There was a guy in Seattle, Washington, Jeff Whitman. He actually stained up nerve terminals with a vital dye, so it keeps the muscles alive when the nerve terminals alive. Opened up the rat muscles of mice and looked at this muscle here on the neck and actually stained it, imaged it, sew it back up a week later, open it up, stain it, image it, and he found out the nerve terminal changed quite a bit. That's very dynamic. It's moving, and it's growing out and retracting on a muscle. So it's not, we don't have stable neuromuscular junctions. They're actually moving. They're actually growing and retracting, growing and retracting. So it's just not staying that way. But you wonder, it's doing that while it's functioning, right? So how is it doing it while it's functioning? And then making new synapses, regressing others, making new ones, work. So pretty neat. But then that one's dominant in development, the other ones pull back. So I think we talked about this a little bit, about fiber types and innervation patterns, and I think, you know, which one occurs in development. And if we start to look at these general differences of fast and slow muscles, generally fast and slow twitch muscle fiber types, is it really the innervation that gets there that actually determines muscle fiber type? Some questions or some research back in the older papers that calcium urine might be a signaling that controls the slow type skeletal muscle gene expression, so they knock that down. They see differences in phenotype. Maybe it has to do with that calcium entry that's coming into the fiber for muscle contraction that's developing it. But remember, the nerve terminals are a bit different on fast muscle fibers and slow muscle fibers, too. The inputs are actually a bit different. People look at these inputs, and they actually look at them when they're competing for each other, and they can look at the individual little swellings on, say, a real inplate, so again, the belly, because these muscle fibers have action potentials. And if you look at it really close, they can actually see size differences in phasic and tonic inplates. So they're different. But then also trying to think about when they're coming together, when they're competing, and then how the others regress away from that. So that's kind of interesting, too. Following up on more details of the competition that might go on, do they actually have to interact somehow to be able to say, oh, which one's what then? Or is it more from the muscle giving some kind of feedback to one terminal versus the other one? Still questions to answer. And the invertebrates, like a Drosophila preparation, much like that crayfish in the water bean, doesn't make action potentials. It's graded, so again, you see a long nerve terminals. Drosophila preparations actually have some of the muscles in the larvae, they have two nerve terminals again on the same muscle fiber. Is that not wild? Two nerve terminals on the same muscle fiber. And it causes the animal to, here, to shine, it causes it to inchworm along, so these long filler muscles that allow it to move along. And you can have synapses again all over the varicosity, if you do the microscopy section. Synapses all over. And the same properties are holding the insects as the crustaceans. The synapses with multiple actor zones, higher output. Synapses that might be big, with only one actor zone, are low output. So you see the same phenomenon throughout the arthropods, insects and crustaceans, and synaptic structure is out there. Beautiful about the Drosophila feature, if you want to convert over, is that every muscle fiber is known or numbered, and the innervation is pretty well known for every muscle fiber. And so people work with a lot of muscle 6 and 7, this is a longitudinal response, is easy to record from, actually, very easy to do. So let's look at the development in a larval system. Day 1, lays an egg, hatches in 24 hours. 24 hours later, it becomes a second instar, early second instar. It continues to grow over the next 24 hours, becomes a late second instar. The next 24 hours, it sheds its exoskeleton, and it's an exoskeleton, becomes an early third instar. 24 hours, it becomes a late and third instar, and the next 24 hours, it becomes a pupa, and now in 5 days, it will become a flock. So in 4 days or 5 days, it has grown from that to that, and you raise the temperature, it will grow faster. Cool down, it will grow slower.
Why does it actually get shorter?
Pardon? It gets wider and it gets shorter. And it's just a bit of the way it does. So it's interesting. And you can actually stage them by looking at the mouthlets. Every time it molts from first to second, or second to third, the number of little teeth on the mouthlets change. So if you want to really stage it carefully, you can actually look at the mouthlets. But now think of the muscle. Wow. That muscle, the first instar, in one segment, one little segment, it's this size. Early seconds, 24 hours, it's grown. Yeah. And then you go to the early third, or late third, and okay, these are all the same magnification. So it's from this, put that in there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe six lengths in 3 days. Rapid growth, but also think of the nerve terminal. It has to keep up with that muscle growth and that fast. So what's happening in the nerve terminal? How does it know to continue to grow the right amount, give the right contraction, right? And the right force for that animal to keep crawling the whole time it's functioning. So that's pretty amazing. And it actually has two different nerve terminals. You blow up the nerve terminal again. A little short one, a big varicosis, and a long one, a thin, and a small little varicosis. It's the same ultrastructure. If you cut across here, they actually have synapses that have a lot of vesicles, but these one will fatigue faster than this one. It's on the same muscle fiber. Isn't that
wild?
Okay, so it's kind of like what determines these two. It's the same thing with mammalian muscle fibers too, right? How is it? Is it the muscle or is it the nerve that is making these differences? And how is that feedback coming back? So we'll just cruise through here. In the mammalian system, maybe see what this. The nerve terminal release is acetylcholine. Actually, that's a negative feedback in the muscle fiber that actually causes clustering of vesicles. I mean, of the postsynaptic receptors. It's this molecule that comes from the nerve terminal called aggrin, and it actually comes from Schwann cells too. Aggrin stimulates the muscle fibers to actually then make changes in expression profiles. So the myonuclei underneath the nerve terminal are different than the rest of the myonuclei. These nuclei underneath the nerve terminal make even different isoforms of the acetylcholine subunits, and they can be more active. And somehow they silence. So when you think of myonuclear domain, these nuclei actually silence the other nuclei. That's why. So it's more than just myonuclear domain. There's differences in how these nuclei function in the muscle fiber. So that's kind of neat too. And that these can actually give a feedback mechanism to cause the acetylcholine receptors to cluster underneath the nerve terminal. So aggrin is very important. And people know the types of cascades, don't memorize this, but these kind of these are kinases, and everywhere you see a star, aggrin, when aggrin is present and works on this receptor, this causes these proteins to interact and actually enhances these protein interactions. So underneath that nerve terminal, that response is completely different than the regions, other places on the muscle fiber that's not innervated. So you're having a different dynamics underneath that nerve terminal than you are from other places on that muscle fiber. And all these then response come back to actually cause acetylcholine receptors to cluster. There's lots of proteins involved in that, and a lot of different phosphorylation steps. The Drosophila, just to kind of wrap that up, it's very similar. They now work out different pathways in the Drosophila system, different kind of proteins, but it's the same kind of binding. These are Wnt signaling the pathways, and they can activate different or suppress gene regulations. And they now know that even in the Drosophila muscle, that the myonuclei are different where the innervation is compared to outside of the innervation pattern. The main point is people are interested in also this feedback mechanism back in the nerve terminal to give the communication. Oh, I have enough synaptic transmission. What's happening? We need to branch. We need to grow. We don't need to grow. And so people are interested in this feedback mechanism in the mouse as well as in the Drosophila systems. And you see here TGF-betas. Right, feeding back to the nerve, so the muscle has to respond to that innervation somehow to give rise to the right feedback so the nerve terminal knows to grow, make more synapses or less synapses, and control itself. To parallel that with convertible preparation, particularly the Drosophila fusion, play with genetics on the Drosophila and control. So this is a glass bottom boat, comes back to the Wnt signaling, turns on PMAD, and then can change gene expression from the motor nerve terminal. A real quick scenario is that the activity onto the muscle can activate its PMADs, actually going through a Wnt signaling pathway. That can then trigger the cell nucleus of the motor neuron to make a protein called TRIO. TRIO is known to actually cause the motor nerve to branch and to continue to grow. So here's a mechanism to feed back the nerve to say, grow. The muscle saying, I don't have enough, or I got too much, and giving that feedback. But again, think about the nuclei, like we've been talking about, on that muscle. You know, what feedback are we having right here versus somewhere down over here where we don't have innervation? So we get these regional differences in the muscle fiber itself. P
people are thinking about a lot of that, and actually in high frequency stimulation, feedback is different than if you're just having tonic activity. So they can actually change that feedback relatively quick. I mean, within minutes of the activity actually changing how the nerve terminal functions. They know that if you have high frequency stimulation and you have allowed vesicles to fuse, this is weird, this is like an exons in a sense. If you allow vesicles from the muscle fibers to fuse, then you can change the properties afterwards of the nerve terminal. So it's really odd what's going on. I think we need to probably stop there and just to kind of think about these receptor aggregations when the nerve is innervating, these nuclei are different than other nuclei. So that's kind of the take home. All right? Good? All right.